Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friends Show, the Wednesday edition. I'm your host, Nicholas Sorimer, and today I'm joined once again by the venerable and wise Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
Well, if you say I'm venerable and wise, I'll accept it.
Very good, very good. And of course, we are also once again joined by Mr. Becky Matlobo, who has not been on the show for a little while, and he has been savaging me behind the scenes, demanding to be on the Daily Friends Show. So, Becky, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick, for having me on, and to the viewers of the Daily Friend, just know that I've been fighting a losing battle until now to have you back on the show because I've missed you all.
Excellent stuff. All right, let's get into our first story for today. And this is a study which comes out of the University of Johannesburg, UJ. The study is titled Energy Racism. And its headline conclusion, as reported in the media, is that black working class in townships bears the burden of South Africa's electricity crisis. So the paper aims to explore the experiences, responses, and solutions of community members regarding the energy crisis. It goes on to say, everyone is having problems with electricity, everyone has experienced load shedding, but people who live in Soweto and other working class townships have bigger problems with electricity. Among other things, victims of what the paper refers to as racial capitalism have been robbed of their access to safe, clean, reliable, and affordable supply of electricity. It continues, the demise of apartheid did not eradicate some key forms of oppression, exploitation, and domination in a new, in square quotes, democratic South Africa. Race, class, and gender remain potent predictors of economic and social well-being. Racial capitalism continues, but in conditions of the latter is a racist policy targeting black areas for power failures aimed at reducing SA's energy demand given Eskom's inability to cope. In an interview given after the study was published on SAFM, director of UJ Center for Sociological Research and Practice, who I believe was also a co-author of the paper, Dr. Trevor Ngwanye, said no one was paying attention to how the electricity crisis is being experienced by people in black townships in the villages and shacks. We found that black working class people suffer the most and bear the brunt of the crisis in SA. They suffer more power failures and have less equal access to equal treatment. So, Becky, there's a number of issues we can unpack here. One is, firstly, I just want you to tell us what exactly load reduction is. But secondly, this feels to me like a thing we've seen very much in South African academia, particularly in the kind of social sciences, which is all the social studies, where you take whatever a problem is, whether it's the circular problem of electricity or water or whatever, and you try to cram it into the square hole of racial capitalism, racism, structural oppression, all these other things. I don't know what to make of this. Becky, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, Nick, just to start off there, you asked me what load reduction is. And for viewers, what load reduction is essentially is in communities where there is a large proportion of households that have illegal connection in terms of power, then what happens is that the local municipality implements load reduction where the power essentially is cut off for an average of about 5 hours. These are particular areas that I know of, such as that of Vosloorus, as well as some areas in the East Rand, Katlehong areas and so forth. Now, in this particular point here, Nick, is that, yeah, of course, there are load reduction in these areas, and predominantly these areas are poor areas. However, what I struggle to find here is actually to understand whether this issue is deep-rooted in racism, whereas the cabinet involved that is responsible for the failure of Eskom as well as its declining capacity has been largely a black cabinet. And its failures, unfortunately, do impact a large proportion of South Africans as well as that of poor South Africans who are predominantly black South Africans. So here, the issue here is not that this is capitalism that is exploiting people. And another thing that I'd like to also add here, Nick, is that one of the things that was said here is that nothing changed for the black working class over the years since 1994. And this is unbelievably untrue for an academic paper to say this. Look at employment. Look at income levels for black working class. Look at the labor participation rates from 1997 until 2007. What you'll find is that the employment level for black South Africans doubled, as well as for South Africans. You'll find an increase of black individuals availing themselves to work because they were barred before 1994, before democracy in the country. You'll see the increase of middle class in the country. You'll see an increase in service delivery, as well as in areas such as rural Eastern Cape, which received electricity in 2007, although it is, I have to say, quite unreliable. But that is reflective of a policy of policies that have been implemented by the ruling government, as well as the respective municipalities when it comes to the failure of service delivery. And those are not the issues of the whites. Those are not the issues of a particular set of racial class, would be it white, be it another, or be it tribal. This is completely an ideological issue. An ideological issue shaped the policy in which the country has been pursuing over the past 10 years, resulting in load shedding as well as road reduction that we've seen over the past years.
So what's interesting to me is how it seems that from the outset this paper went to this thing we've often talked about, which is how academia focuses very much on people's feelings and perceptions. It says so in the title. It seeks to explore experiences, responses, and solutions of community members. And also it was conducted in Soweto, which I think perhaps is not entirely representative of a lot of poorer areas around South Africa. Terence, what do you make of this? You also had some comments, not just on the paper itself, but also on the author associated with it, one of the authors associated.
Look, there's two things that I'd like to pick up on. I think Becky's made the sort of substantive points, but the person who delivered the interview that caught her eye, Dr. Trevor Ngwane, he has a very long pedigree of association with, let's say, this community-based leftist politics. This is his brand, basically. And it's interesting if you look at his profile on the UJ website. He's referred to as a scholar activist. So I think that one must be careful about assuming that there's a sort of academic dispassion here. I think that you're coming with a very distinct distinct approach and understanding of these things. Secondly, I love the phrase "nobody talks about." We hear this all the time. Generally, it's saying that I'm throwing open the windows of truth and light because I'm talking about the thing nobody else has spoken about. I don't know where he gets this, because he's certainly been talking about this issue since the 1990s, and I'm old enough to remember that. So it's not that nobody is talking about it, and I think that some of the issues that they raise here are issues that do merit serious consideration. Long before blackouts became the sort of life-crippling experience that they've become for the South African economy, they were a regular feature in Soweto, in part, I think, because of poor maintenance, vandalism, and illegal connections. I mean, these are very, very real issues. South Africa has attempted to deal with this, and I'd tack something onto what Becky has said through the rollout of one of the developing world's largest welfare states. I'm actually not an opponent of this. I think that given our high levels of unemployment and poverty, and I think their structural nature, I don't really see much useful alternative. But it's the inability to get economic growth going in a way that puts people in a position to drive their own mobility that has kept people kind of locked in this downward spiral. And I think that the idea that this is all the predations of rapacious free market capitalism is about as unconvincing as the New York Times telling us that we had this Ayn Randian free speech dystopia in the 1970s. The problem is that you had a government that talked sort of market-based solutions up to a point, but had this huge destructive statist impulse, which it wanted to use for patronage purposes. So I think we ended up getting the worst of both worlds. Yes, a sort of a rhetorical commitment to a developmental state that became a vehicle for plunder. Halfway committed to a private sector that was going to make a contribution, but distrusting it all the way. So we got neither the sort of capitalist dynamism, which, you know, might make up for the lack of conscience, or any kind of, reasonable, state-driven egalitarianism, for want of a better term. So yeah, you know, I think that racial capitalism can sit this one out. It's a lot more complicated. But then again, if one is a scholar activist, perhaps one, you know, wants a particular outcome.
Yes, no, I suspect that that's at least part of the framing here. But I mean, some of the issues raised here are very as you say, very important. But there are, I think, some pieces that are lost here. For one, load reduction is very much, as Becky said, something that comes a lot of ways from illegal connections. A lot of areas you have, often poor areas, you have a slightly older, more built up area. Maybe it's got some bond houses, maybe it's RDP houses, and they are connected to the proper legal electricity grid. And then you'll have a new, sometimes informal, usually an informal settlement, squatter camp, that kind of thing, which pops up nearby, and people there, they want to get hooked into the electricity grid. So not willing to wait for government to do it, they will plug themselves into the mains themselves. And this causes an enormous amount of drama across South Africa's poorer areas, because the people who are in the legal area not only get hit by load reduction, which affects the whole area, regardless of whether you're legal or illegal, but their infrastructure often blows up. I know that in the area around in Joburg, around Rivoli, I've been there a couple of times, and I know some people there. They say that every now and again there's a squatter camp there that plugs into the electricity mains, and there's a giant explosion after a day or two, and everyone in the whole suburb loses power, and they have to come and replace a lot of electricity infrastructure. It's not really sustainable. Becky, I just want to get your final thoughts on this topic in general, but also, I think one of the ideas that is pushed by the sort of scholar activists here, and I came across this at WITS, is that the real problem here is that anyone is actually being charged for electricity or water, particularly the poor. That none of them should be charged for electricity or water. These are human rights that they should be given to anyone. Is that the right approach?
No, Nick, for the simple reason that humans respond towards incentive. If you make things free and for people not to pay for them, then what you're going to do is that you're going to allow people to respond to that incentive of that it's free, therefore I can use it whenever I like, I can use it how wasteful I would, and that would be a strain on everyone else, resulting in load shedding, more severe load shedding compared to the one that we're seeing right now. The solution to this here, Nick, is more options for millions of South Africans. That is what free market is. It's a failure of academia to recognize this, that free markets comes down to the choice towards the consumer. The consumer is the one that dictates which product is going to be produced, which product is not going to be sold. And when it comes to such important issues such as electricity, it is of utmost importance for this, for consumers to have a variety of options. And with that, the competition that then ensues, resulting in lower prices in terms of energy costs, which is the usual thing once you allow a free market to do what it does best, providing the best value for their consumers at the lowest price. Without that, you're going to continue to see nationalization, you're going to continue to see high levels of electricity prices combined with load shedding. So that is not the solution that is being purported by this academic paper. The right solution, rather.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our next topic, and this is inflation. So inflation has hit 5.9% for the first time in 5 months. Annual consumer price inflation has remained unchanged at 5.9% in April of 2022. Stats SA reported today. This is the third time in 5 months that the rate has been so high. and is right at the edge of the upper rate of the target for inflation of 6% that the South African Reserve Bank has set. Rise in inflation was hit mostly by transport costs, which were up almost 15%. Despite some of the tax relief granted on fuel levies, they were much higher in April of this year. They were 29% more expensive, or fuel was 29% more expensive in April of this year than it was the year before. Prices on food, non-alcoholic beverages increased by 6% year on year. And there was a small increase on a couple of other things like meat and stuff like that. But generally, it looks like transport is the main driver here. So, Becky, what should we think about this? Do you think it's going to continue to go up? Is it going to stay with us for a while? We've seen all over the world that despite the the insistences, that a lot of countries have been hit by inflation, despite the insistence of a lot of leaders, particularly in the US, that this was all going to go away pretty quickly. It seems to be sticking around. What do you make of this?
Yeah, the term used by most politician officials was that it would be temporary. You saw this type of talking points among the Western governments. And this year, unfortunately, has been that of inflation, Yannick. Every single week this year, we've seen the reports of certain items becoming more expensive, such as that of fertilizer prices, for example, dramatically increasing, impacting farmers. And now what we are currently finding now with South Africa's high inflation level of 5.9%, just below the target band of 3 to 6%, but it's still historically high when you compare ourselves to our previous inflation numbers. Now, what does this mean? Unfortunately, this negatively impacts consumers in the country. You mentioned there, such as that of transportation. Overall inflation is sitting at 5.9%, but the individual items, unfortunately, hurt consumers the most, such as that of transportation, such as that of oil and fats used for cooking. That has increased about 21%. That is a dramatic increase, particularly that will impact the poorest of the poor in the country. These are things used for cooking, for example, as well as the where do we see inflation heading in the next few weeks. Unfortunately, we're seeing inflation at very high levels here, Nick. When you're looking at the consequences between Russia and Ukraine, that had an impact on wheat and corn prices as well as fuel prices. Those will add inflationary pressures in South Africa. What China has done with its zero COVID policy, implementing lockdowns, that's disrupting trade, which will result in elevated supply chain pressures, already on elevated supply chain pressures coming into 2022. So I do foresee that inflation to remain at elevated levels. The central bank, South African Central Bank, is closely looking at this, and tomorrow I believe that they will hike interest rates. I believe they might hike it between 25 to 50 basis points. Now, what this means is that it'll be more expensive for you to service your debt if you are in debt, and it'll be more expensive for businesses to take on debt as well as households. So it results in the hampering of economic activity already in an environment of low growth. Yeah, so unfortunately, things are not looking good from an inflationary perspective as well as that from an interest rate perspective.
Terence, I just want to get your thoughts on this in general, but also on the political consequences. I think historically speaking, one of the worst things that can happen for any incumbent government is to have a lot of inflation, particularly when people have been used to a period of low inflation. It makes consumers' lives much more difficult. It really frustrates people. And I think that the pressure it puts on shows that, look, my prediction is that a lot of incumbent governments across the world are going to be in serious danger of politically falling over the next couple of years if inflation does not go away. And I think a lot of polling already suggests that that might be the case. Terence, what do you make of this? What do you make of the possible political consequences?
Well, here's an interesting thing in terms of linking it to the previous issue we discussed about the effect on less affluent people. Inflation, particularly when it revolves around the means to satisfy your basic needs, is going to hit poorer people far more aggressively than it hits it's the wealthier. For a household in Northcliffe, perhaps it means fewer takeout dinners. For a household in Deep Sluit, it could mean whether you have mealy meal to eat. I mean, that's that sort of thing. I mean, cooking oil, bread, these are basic food, foodstuffs that, that we're concerned about. The other interesting thing is that it's interesting, despite the centrality of inflation to our lives, how it plays virtually no role in political debate. I wonder if, you know, 10% of our parliamentarians could give you an intelligent answer about inflation. They can talk with eloquence and passion about statues of Louis Botha or students peeing on each other or whatever. You know, top tip, we don't do that. That's disgusting. And I think that guy deserves to have the book and everything else thrown at him. But the point is that that sort of thing animates discussion. Cost of living, you know, it's almost like it's too complicated for us to talk about. And something that has, that has sort of circled in the outer rims of our debate is the idea of, abandon control of inflation, just let it ride, and somehow, you'll get growth through that. I don't think people can actually explain the mechanisms, but it's the idea that we can print our way out of our problems. It's nice, it's easy. There's no need for policy change. You can keep your ideology, but somehow if we just print trillions of rands, we'll just all be wealthy and everything will be fine. I think the problems, I think the consequences of that would be to use another dreadful South Africanism, too dreadful to contemplate.
Yeah, if I may add to Terrence's point.
Go ahead.
Nick, and that was like, how do governments define inflation? If you ask the Biden administration, inflation is caused by the wealthy, the extreme wealthy in the U.S. But it does have major implications when it comes to low-income countries such as that of other African countries here in Africa. If we just bring it a little bit back home, you can see here the correlation. Once you start to see the prices of basic necessities increasing dramatically, already in an environment where a large proportion of people are poor, talking about the DRC, as well as here in South Africa, where 12.5 million South Africans have been without a job, looking at the latest unemployment numbers. That, unfortunately, ferments an environment for political instability within the country, as well as that in other low-income countries around Africa, and as well as around the world.
Yes, no, very important to keep in mind. All right, so let's move on to our next topic. And this is, I think, a story that you hear every now and again in SA, and one that I don't think we've talked about before on the show, but it's perhaps worth discussing some of what's going on perhaps in the broader context that causes an incident like this. So I'm sure everyone's seen a story like this before. Some paramedics in Mpumalanga on Sunday were called out to a farm. They were told that there was a woman in labor and they needed to come help her. The person who called said, please could you stop in this location on the side of the road and we will give you directions. This was also at night. The ambulance went out, and they were robbed at gunpoint. When they arrived at the place to receive their directions, they were held at gunpoint by several men who took them hostage, took their cell phones, tied them up with cable ties, kept them in the ambulance, and basically stripped the vehicle of all the valuable parts. Eventually, the victims managed to escape, alert their supervisor, and be rescued. But this is not the first time we've seen paramedics or ambulances attacked, robbed. I know the city of Joburg has, I think, I'm not sure if it still had it, but as at one time it had an armored ambulance, which was used specifically in, I think, the center of town around Heelbrow when it was New Year's Eve, because I don't know if you've ever been to that part of town or seen it on TV, but things get a bit exciting. At the New Year's parties then. A lot of stuff gets thrown off of roofs and it's quite dangerous. So you really must wonder, like, when people are abusing the medical emergency systems like this, it really, to me, suggests that we've got some serious problems with social trust. And I guess also this is just another indicator of how crime doesn't just mean that you lose your stuff. It really affects service delivery, because can you imagine being called out anywhere in that location in the future if the paramedics think they're going to be robbed. Terence, your thoughts?
Well, once again, let's come back to our first story. Who does this affect? And once again, I'm old enough to remember when these sort of things the debate around crime, there were deliberate attempts by senior politicians and officials, and this is the 1990s, to say, oh, this is just sort of a white racist suburban paranoia. I think Charles Kakula was the Minister of Police and said, we never hear complaints from township folk. You know, to which one can just let out this. A large
has he ever lot. Talked to someone who lives in a township?
Well, before? Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, there it is. One police officer that I spoke to about this, whose beat kind of covers both suburban and township areas, said, yeah, look, suburbanites can make their voices heard. They're eloquent. They, you know, basically, you're going to get coverage. He says that township folk just do not have the same visibility. But, you know, for them, he says the threat of crime is just it's exponentially more serious. Now, just like, you know, with Eskom, when the sort of public provision doesn't work or where it's inadequate or whatever, if you're fortunate to have a bit of money, you can, you know, buy a generator or, you know, do whatever you've got to do. If you're dependent on the public provision, you sit in the dark. If you have a bit of money, you know, you can maybe, you know, pay for a security firm that can then make a reality show out of it to come and protect you. If you don't, well, you know, you just are exposed at, you know, at that much more elevated a risk. If you are living in a marginally better policed area, you know, the ambulance that comes to you or to your house will get there. If not, well, you know, you end up with a situation. But yeah, you know, I mean, many of these are cases of problems that were allowed to fester or were denied, and you know, sooner or later they start to blow up in your face, and eventually you can't spin your way out of them. And yeah, you know, it's people living in shacks in abject poverty who are going to suffer the worst fallouts of this.
Your thoughts before we close up?
I 100% agree with Terence there, Nick. Another example is looking at Boston Uber drivers, for example. They will tell you the best stories of what happened to them. Unfortunately, not the best, the most horrific stories, rather, of what happens to them when they receive a request for a ride at a particular area. And then, unfortunately, they get robbed and their cars get hijacked. And then that leads them to be quite reluctant on going to those routes and picking up people in those routes. And unfortunately, the people in those particular areas then suffer the consequences of not receiving those services. And to Terence's point there, in township areas, crime is so large there that people do not even find the need to report it, largely due to the fact that they don't see that the police will do something about it. It happens for them on a daily occasion, and in often terms, unfortunately, they have to take matters into their own hands when it comes to mob justice, for example. So these are really huge issues that needs to be tackled, and if they don't, unfortunately, dire situations may occur in the future.
Well said. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Just a reminder that we will not be on air tomorrow because we are doing nefarious things amongst ourselves, and so we won't have time, unfortunately, to record the show. But we hope that you enjoyed the episode today, and if you liked it, please subscribe to us. Subscribe on YouTube, on one of the podcast apps, on wherever you're listening to this. And also check out the dailyfriend.co.za, where all of us, all three of us, are published from time to time. Plus many, many more. If you don't like any of us three, I'm sure you'll find a writer there who you at least find interesting and worth reading. But anyway, thank you very much. And we will see you next week on the Daily Friend Show. Have a great one, everyone.